The interactive portion of the show, your phone calls when we come back. Return to the God Hypothesis in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie, back with Dr. Stephen Meyer, Return of the God Hypothesis in your phone calls. Stephen, is mainstream science tipping toward the Return of the God Hypothesis?
Well, I would say there's still a tremendous amount of resistance, but there are more and more dissident scientists who are breaking with the materialistic viewpoint that we inherited from the late 19th century. And I found just that there's a tremendous network of scientists internationally that are interested in the evidence for intelligent design, doing research from a design-friendly framework. And just in the correspondence I've had about this book with physicists and cosmologists, astrophysicists, I think there's a tremendous shift taking place. I don't think we're not fully there yet, but the trajectory is, I think, into a more God-friendly approach to science and the recognition that some of these very big discoveries about the origin and fine-tuning of the universe, the discovery of information in living systems, the big bursts of information and form that we see in the fossil record, all of these things, I think, are pointing away from the mindless materialistic processes or perspective that we inherited from the 19th century into a more theistic-friendly one.
Wasn't Einstein a believer in God?
Einstein was early in his career a classic scientific materialist. He resisted the evidence for the Big Bang and then later declared that it was the biggest blunder of his scientific career, and later adopted a kind of, it was a sort of pantheist perspective. He thought that there was some kind of mind behind the universe. He didn't attempt to identify it. Some thought that his perspective was similar to the philosopher Spinoza. But he had definitely made a shift from strict materialism to an openness to some sort of mind or spirit behind the universe.
Some scientists will say that the God hypothesis is merely an easy excuse because we don't have the answers.
Well, I use a method of reasoning in the book known as inference to the best explanation, and interestingly, it's used in many scientific disciplines, especially those that are concerned with reconstructing the past and trying to identify the causes of events in the remote past. So fields like cosmology, archaeology, forensics, evolutionary biology, geology, the historical sciences. And what I've argued is that if we're going to pursue the inquiry in the most rigorous fashion, we should be open to all possible explanations, not just those that posit materialistic causes. And when you open the inquiry up to all possibilities and you find evidence like digital code or fine-tuning, those are features of systems which in our experience universally are the result of intelligent agency. In other words, in any other realm of experience, if we found digital code or a complex information processing system, or if we find a finely tuned system that accomplishes an overall purpose or goal, in our uniform and repeated experience, systems that have those features always come from a mind. So I don't think this isn't a God of the gaps argument. This is an argument from our positive knowledge of cause and effect and what we routinely see in the world around us. It takes a mind to generate information. It takes a mind to generate finely tuned systems. And in the case of the origin of the material universe itself, that's an event that clearly cannot be explained by a prior material cause. So this isn't a cop-out. This is reasoning to the best explanation in light of the evidence that we have about these big events in biological and cosmic history, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the fine-tuning that makes it possible.
Stephen, atheists who don't believe in God, what do they say about the formation of the universe?
Well, interestingly, there have been a number of attempts to circumvent the evidence for the beginning with a very abstract approach in physics called quantum cosmology, which attempts to explain the origin of the universe as a result of the laws of quantum physics. But an interesting paradox has developed in the attempts to do this that has been recognized by the leading physicists who have been involved in this effort, and that is that there's something very strange about the laws of physics. If you want to explain the origin of the material universe, matter, space, time, and energy, from the laws of physics, you have to ask, as one physicist did, what are the tablets upon which those laws are written? There's no matter, space, time, or energy. The laws of physics typically describe what matter and energy do within the cosmos. They don't tell us where the universe came from. And so one physicist, Alexander Vilenkin, has asked the very penetrating philosophical question about his own inquiries in quantum cosmology, how could math alone create a physical universe? He says, what tablets could these laws have been written on before there was matter and energy and space and time? Math, he says, that the laws of physics are always written as mathematical equations. Math is conceptual. It exists in a mind. And then he asks the question, is it possible then we're really saying that that a mind predates the universe? So even the attempt to get around the beginning of the universe and the natural implication of a transcendent, I would argue, God hypothesis has resulted in another approach to explaining its origin that has its own theistic implications, that explaining the universe from math is really explaining the universe from a conceptual or mental realm that implies a pre-existing mind.
To the phones we go. First-time caller Mike in Colorado. Welcome to the program, Mike.
Hello, George, and it's a pleasure to talk with you, Dr. Meyer. I've read both of your books, and, you know, it's interesting because when I think of all of the great information that's there and then contrast that with, you know, the likes of Jerry Coyne and Richard Dawkins and whatnot, who just fail basically to get into the specific detail that you're able to convey in your books, I wonder, and I just looked at your page, The Return of the God Hypothesis, why, or maybe it's about time, to confront evolution directly in the sense of producing a book that looks at its premises and whatever evidence they think they can pull up to ID, because, you know, so many high school students are taught, and you know this, that quote-unquote evolution is a fact, but it's far from that, and the more we know about the universe and specifics of life itself, with respect, for instance, to the code that you mentioned, the more we know it's just an impossibility. So what about a book the likes of which would be, like, Why Evolution Must Be False for high school kids?
Well, we have a book that we've produced, and I'm a co-author of it. It's called Explore Evolution, The Arguments For and Against Neo-Darwinism, and it's a book that looks at the basic argument for the modern form of Darwinian evolution, and then also reports and explains some of the scientific challenges to that theory as they are now being developed in peer-reviewed scientific articles and literature around the world. I attended a conference in 2016 in London that was sponsored by the Royal Society, one of the world's oldest scientific society, and it was convened by a group of evolutionary biologists who have acknowledged that the standard textbook theory of evolution, neo-Darwinism, is failing precisely because the mutation natural selection mechanism lacks the creative power to explain the origin of major new forms of life in the history of life. The mutation selection mechanism does a great job of explaining minor variations, things like finch beaks getting a little bigger or smaller in response to varying weather patterns, but it doesn't explain the origin of birds and mammals and the animals and the events like the Cambrian explosion in the first place. So there is an acknowledgement within mainstream evolutionary biology that the theories that we've inherited since the 19th century and even the 1950s are now not adequate. And so I think there is a greater openness to the question of design. And this is where I really appreciate those new atheist writers like Dawkins and Coyne and Lawrence Krauss. They do a very good job of defining the key issues. Dawkins says, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Question is, he thinks the appearance of design is an illusion, and we've been arguing, no, there are certain features of living systems that are best explained by an actual designing intelligence, not by an undirected process. He does a lovely way of he frames the issue beautifully, but I think he comes to the wrong answer.
Is it possible, Stephen, that intelligent design can mesh with evolution, and that was just merely the process of the intelligent design?
I think it is. The question is exactly what kind of evolution are we talking about, and what is the scope of it? I don't think any of the leading members of the intelligent design research community doubt that natural selection and random mutation are real processes, nor do they doubt that there is change that takes place. But most of us think that that change takes place within the limits of pre-existing genetic information in given groups of organisms, rather than being something that is unlimited in its scope. But that's something that's for debate. So the key issue is the information that's needed to get first life going and new forms of life going. I think once you have a repository of genetic and other forms of biological information, there is variability that takes place, and that is properly described as evolutionary change. The question is whether that change is unlimited and whether there is and whether it's solely undirected. And that's where we challenge the standard view and say that, no, there must have been an input of information from an intelligence to get the key forms of life going, and certainly the first living cell.
What turned you around? What event?
Well, that's a great question. I attended a conference when I was in my first year as a young scientist. The conference came to the city where I was working. That was a group of scientists investigating. It was convened by a local group who brought together some world-class scientists who were investigating the big questions at the intersection between science and philosophy, which is what I'd always been interested in. And those three questions were the origin and fine-tuning of the universe, number one, the origin of life, number two, and third was the origin and nature of human consciousness. And in listening to the presentations and the debates, because the conference was divided between those who had a strictly materialistic, atheistic perspective on one side and those who had theistic leanings on the other, and I was seized by the degree to which it seemed the theists had the intellectual initiative in the conversation. And one of the first speakers at the conference was a great cosmologist and astrophysicist, Alan Sandage, who had been a graduate assistant of Edwin Hubble. He'd been involved in verifying the redshift evidence in the different quadrants of the night sky and was intimately connected with the, intimately aware of the immense evidence for the expanding universe and therefore the idea that the universe had a beginning. He'd been a longtime agnostic and announced at this conference that he'd come to believe in God not despite the scientific evidence, not in spite of the scientific evidence, but rather because of it. And there were several other scientists at that conference who had announced similar intellectual conversions or changes of position away from materialism and towards either intelligent design or some sort of theistic-friendly perspective. And that's where I got very interested in pursuing more of these questions. I was an industry geophysicist at the time. Within a year, I was off to Cambridge, England, to pursue a doctorate on origin of life biology and the philosophy of science.
Let's go to Mimi in Midland, Texas. Hello, Mimi.
Hi, George. How are you? And
I'm
how are
good.
You, Dr. Meyer?
Very well. Thank you, Mimi, for calling in.
Oh, you're welcome. I have a couple of comments, and then I have a story.
Okay.
That's something that happened to me when I was six. I had not started school yet. I certainly didn't know anything about science and not very much about religion. But one day I went running outside, jumped off what was then a high porch, and the minute my feet touched the ground, God came into my mind.
Why?
Now, why this happened, I don't know, because we weren't big churchgoers.
And when you say God came into your mind, what had transpired?
Nothing.
Nothing. You just thought of God when you jumped, huh?
And I turned around, went back in, and I said, Mama, I said, when was God born? And, of course, she looked very startled. And she said, God was never born, and God does not die. And you know, I wasn't expecting, you know, what she said, but I went back out. I had a tree that I sat under all the time. And for the next 3 days, I thought of this concept of no beginning and no end.
Yeah.
And my brain had what wasn't altogether pleasant, a stretching sensation. And I finally kind of got frustrated with it and stopped thinking about it, but it has stuck with me my whole life.
You know, that's a fascinating story, Mimi, and many people, and especially young people, have spiritual experiences of those kinds. and then later find that they get talked out of them, especially when they get to the university years and they encounter professors who may be aggressively proselytizing a more atheistic perspective. And pollsters are picking up on this now. They're finding there's been a tremendous rise of agnosticism and atheism among young people. The pollsters call the phenomenon the rise of the nuns, the religiously unaffiliated. And when we probe that group of young people, we find that typically when pollsters do, they find that science has played an outsized role in cementing a disaffection with belief in God. And in fact, two-thirds of young atheists have answered the say that the findings of science make belief in God less likely. And part of the argument and, I hope, import of my new book is to show that that perception is unnecessary, that the findings of science are actually pointing to God, and therefore there's no reason necessarily to doubt the legitimacy of those kind of subjective experiences that people have where they sense a connection to the deity. So I would I'd be the last person to try to talk you out of that and instead say that, you know, that science itself may be underscoring the legitimacy of that innate sense that many people have of the existence and reality of God.
My mother always would tell me, Stephen, still does, that God always was and always will be. That was her answer.
And interestingly, George, that's the opposite of the perspective of many of the scientists who embrace what's called scientific materialism or naturalism. You may remember the great Cosmos series by Carl Sagan. And
yeah, absolutely.
The mantra, the universe is all there ever was, all there ever will be. It was a kind of inversion of that theistic perspective. Instead of God being the thing from which everything else came, the eternal self-existent entity that from which everything else is derived, the materialistic view says that it's matter, energy, space, and time that have always been here. And yet, this is why the new discoveries in cosmology and physics are so important, because they contradict that maxim of the materialists and suggest that, no, the material universe itself came into being a finite time ago. It hasn't always been here. Therefore, it's not a good candidate to be what philosophers sometimes call the prime reality or the ultimate reality. It hasn't always been here. It's not eternal and self-existent. It requires an explanation, a causal explanation that is separate from itself.
It is miraculous, regardless of how you say it and how you look at it. It's a miracle, isn't it?
Well, a miracle, I think, philosophically speaking, is an act of God.
I agree.
And many scholars in not only in the sciences, but in fields like biblical studies and other disciplines have denied the possibility of miracles since the late Enlightenment, but they have done so largely because they came to doubt the existence of God. Miracles are impossible if God does not exist, because a miracle is an act of God. But if there's strong evidence for the existence of God, then it becomes possible to consider that a miracle may have occurred, and therefore you need to look at the evidence more specifically. So I think this is another question that's beginning to shift. As the evidence for God mounts, I think people are becoming more open to the idea that there might have been miracles at certain points in the past, as recorded in the religious scriptures, or even in our own experiences.
Stephen, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we're going to be talking about geoengineering with Dane Wigington, how they're affecting climate and just about everything else that affects our lives. So I'm looking forward to that. That's next hour. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Stephen Meyer and take final phone calls. His book is called Return of the God Hypothesis. Welcome back. Our final segment with Dr. Stephen Meyer. We're talking about his book, Return of the God Hypothesis. Once again, Stephen, well done on the book. I mean, well thought out, and it shows how much you care about the universe.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the compliment very much, and just getting to share some of these ideas with your very interesting audience, and they're good questions.
If there was an old-time scientist from way gone back, the Galileo types, that you could meet with and talk with about the existence of God in the universe, who would that be?
Hands down, Sir Isaac Newton.
Really?
Yeah, I did quite a lot of work on Newton's work on gravitation when I was in grad school, especially my first year, and at one of the breaks over the holidays when all the undergraduate students had gone home, I was furiously working on essays deep into the night. And one night I walked down. It was foggy in Cambridge, and I walked down to the medieval colleges and sat outside Newton's room in his former room in Trinity College, and just tried to think what he had been thinking when he was pulling all these ideas together. And he had a profound sense that what we call the laws of nature are themselves mysterious, because at bottom, the fundamental forces of physics describe things that always happen in an orderly, mathematically regular way, but we don't know why. And Newton was challenged to explain what causes gravity, because it's very mysterious if you think of the moon exerting a force on the tides on planet Earth, but yet the moon isn't touching the Earth. There's no pushing and pulling. And this was the famous concept of action at a distance that was pioneered by Newton. And he was pressed to explain the cause of gravitation. And he said that in Latin the phrase was hypothesis non fingo. I don't feign to know the cause. But one of the other great mathematicians and physicists at the time, Leibniz, said, well, if it's not a material cause, then Newton, you must actually think that it's a perpetual miracle, that God lies behind what we call the laws of nature. And Newton actually acknowledged in a private correspondence to a theologian that that's exactly what he did think, that, as one of my Cambridge supervisors put it, Newton's view was that what we call the laws of nature are a consequence of, quote, constant spirit action, that there's something mysterious about why the universe has these beautiful regularities that we can describe with math, and yet we really don't know what causes these regularities and why they're uniform throughout the universe. So Newton had a deep, deep, both philosophical acumen as well as scientific perspective that he integrated with his theological view. So I think he'd have been a fascinating person to talk to.
Well, let's go to Ernest in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Thanks for calling, Ernest. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing.
I had another discussion like this when I was in college with a mathematician who also brought up the God hypotenuse in this discovery, in his discussion. But he brought up the thing about where Einstein said that God doesn't play dice with the universe. Well, I had to come back with him and tell him that I've seen pictures of whole galaxies colliding with each other. We ourselves, the Earth, you know, we call ourselves in the Goldilocks zone, but we subject to the sun, you know, throwing off solar flares.
That's right.
By the Earth, you know, at any minute. And then plus we got this other thing called gamma ray bursts. Now, if there is such a creator or a intelligent design, then why put us in a shooting gallery? I mean, it's just like an artist who made a great creation and then set it somewhere where it can get hit and run over. It doesn't make any sense. And so, therefore, like, I don't understand how we can have a design, intelligent designer who, like, doesn't, you know, like I said, it seems like we're just out here, you know, and there's no explanation as far as, for me, is how can we be an intelligent design from something that created us, but still put us in a situation where we can go extinct.
He puts us in jeopardy, Stephen.
Well, first a point about the astronomy and then a more general theological point. There's a wonderful astronomer named Guillermo Gonzalez who has pioneered a concept called the circumstellar habitable zone, and also the galactic habitable zone. It turns out that around our sun, there's a very narrow band where life could exist. And within our galaxy, there's a very narrow band in which life could exist. And we happen to be in both a planet in the circumstellar habitable zone, and our solar system is in the galactic habitable zone. Our planet is protected from a lot of those cosmic radiation by our magnetic field. We have exactly the right axial tilt that allows for there to be seasons. We're the right distance from the sun to be neither too hot nor too cold. We exist in the right kind of orbit so we don't get too close to the sun or too far away. And then out in the outer part of our solar system, the planet Jupiter acts as a great vacuum cleaner that, with its huge gravitational field, and it draws in asteroids and other material that could cause damage to planet Earth. So actually, I think our planet is beautifully situated and protected in addition to all the fine-tuning parameters and the fundamental laws of physics that make life possible. So I see exquisite evidence of design, not only in the microcosm of the cell, but also in the way our planetary system and the entire universe have been put together. Now, there is the question of why is there death? Why do bad things happen?
Right.
And if I were just an intelligent design theorist, I might not have any framework for answering those. But I happen to be a traditional Christian. I believe the biblical view that not only was there evidence of original design, or what's called sometimes aboriginal design, but that we should also expect to see evidence of decay. According to the Judeo-Christian religious scriptures, something went wrong in addition to there being an original creation, and the things that we see in nature that are evidence of decay confirm that perspective as well. We don't say, if you see a car that's rusting, that doesn't deny that it was initially designed. It shows that there were processes of decay that ensued after that design. And I think we live in a universe that exhibits both design and subsequent decay. And for me, that confirms the general religious perspective that I hold to.
Next up, let's go to Mike in Denver, Colorado. Michael, go ahead.
Good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you.
Stephen, first of all, thank you so much for your insight and research on this subject and for being here tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
So I had a comment and a question this evening. So, when we look at the general view of what is taught of what a creationist is, it's generally someone who believes in a God who is the, absolute creator of heaven and earth out of nothing but by an act of free will. But, I've always thought of the idea of the creation of the earth and the things that, astrophysicists have attributed the creation of the earth to, like the Big Bang and the formation of the oceans, as, a very miraculous idea in itself. And it leads me to my question, which other, theologians have raised before, which is, do you think that the academia and scientific theory of how the earth was formed, being the Big Bang, could have actually been carried out by God himself? Thank you.
Actually, I do. There's a confusion about the Big Bang, and many religious creationists reject the Big Bang for two reasons. One, they think that it happened longer ago than they're willing to consider, and that's the young Earth perspective. And secondly, they think that the physicists are saying that the Big Bang caused the universe to come into existence. I personally hold to an old Earth and an old universe timeline, but the deeper question of causality is one that I don't think should trouble any religious believer, because the physicists aren't saying that the Big Bang caused the universe to come into existence. The Big Bang is the first effect. It's the first event in which we get matter, space, time, and energy, and it implies the need for a cause separate from itself, separate from matter, space, time, and energy. And this was one of the things that troubled many of the materialistic physicists from the beginning. The great Princeton physicist Robert Dickey said that an infinitely old universe would relieve us of the necessity of explaining the origin of matter at any finite time in the past. But once we discovered, now this is me talking, not Dickey, once we discovered that the universe did have a beginning in a finite time in the past, it suggested the need for an external creator. And many of the physicists, Einstein himself, realized these implications, and this was one of the reasons that the Big Bang theory was resisted by materialists and atheists. But instead, I think, precisely because it has obvious theistic implications, and I explain those more in the book. So, yes, I think the Big Bang is best explained as an act of a transcendent creator beyond the universe.
Let's go to Charles now in Florida, east of the Rockies. Charles, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm going to talk fast because I had celebrated my 80th birthday on January 5th.
Well, happy birthday,
anyway,
sir.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I finally got my nerve up to go to a shrink and see if I could get categorized as a remote viewer. And my whole life I've been seeing the universe very clearly,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Like a cinemascopic lens. So I guess probably the most interesting part of my conversation with you would be what came before the Big Bang. And two words that would describe the proof of the existence of a creator. I'll start with that one first. Down to earth here, the two words that prove it was the existence of a creator would be orgasmic pleasurability, you know, and the intelligent design that had to be there, or this conversation wouldn't be occurring. And now, what came before the Big Bang was something in biblical terms mentioned as eternity, and I guess scientific terms, infinity. Okay, it's a what I see. This is what I'm telling you is I see. I see all these things. I'm a presidential advisor board member to President Trump. Also, first time I got a letter from him, I got three in my mailbox the same day. I'm up to 30 letters now. But okay, so what I see
is a monolith. The beginning of the what came before the Big Bang. Let me frame the question a little differently. Every philosophical system has to posit something as the prime reality or the ultimate reality from which everything else came. Theism, traditional belief in God, has posited a conscious, eternal, very powerful, omniscient creator as the thing from which everything else came. The other system, competing system of thought in the West is materialism, and that's the idea that matter and energy are eternal and self-existent, and everything has evolved from them, and eventually we humans conceived of the idea of God, but not God as a reality. And I think the new cosmology suggesting that the universe itself had a beginning implies that matter and energy are not good candidates to be the eternal self-existent thing. They are contingent. They come into existence at a finite time in the past. Before that, we might think of time existing in another realm, maybe in the realm of God, or we might think of God existing in a timeless realm, bringing time and space, matter and energy into existence. But the one thing we can't think, the one thing that is an inadequate explanation is the idea that matter produced the material universe because matter, space-time, and energy come into existence a finite time ago.
And in the waning moments here, Stephen, tell folks how they can get your book and your websites again.
The website is returnofthegodhypothesis.com. The book is available at all online sellers, Barnes & Noble, Indie Books, Books A Million, Amazon, and in the major bookstores as well.
Could you be wrong? Could all of us be wrong about our belief in intelligent design?
Absolutely, but I don't attempt to provide proof for the existence of God in the book. What I do is show that there are strong reasons to believe in God, and that positing God provides the best explanation of the big events in biological and cosmological of cosmic and biological origins, better than materialism, pantheism, or deism, or even the space alien concept of the designers. So that's the kind of argument you make in science. Scientists themselves don't try to get proof. They try to provide theories. They try to come up with theories that provide the best explanation of the evidence. And that's what I've tried to do in this book.
Stephen, let's not let 8 years go by before you come back on again, okay?
Let's not do that. This has been a fascinating conversation for me, and I really appreciate your interest.
You and I will be in our hundreds if we do that.
Yeah, exactly. Let's keep after this.
All right, good luck with this work, and stay strong. You're going to have your critics, your peers, but keep the faith.
It's a great conversation, and we've started it tonight on your wonderful show. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Up next, Dane Wigington joins us. We're going to talk about the minuses of geoengineering. Just what are they doing with GMOs? What are they doing to the climate? What are they doing to us? We're going to have that and much more. And also, don't forget to sign up for our free YouTube channel. Go to coasttocoastam.com. Up in the right-hand corner, you'll see all the icons for YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. Click them all and sign up. It's all free.